Welcome to Now Appalachia. The Appalachian region covers 13 states in the U.S., and over 25 million people call the region home. This podcast profiles the authors and publishers with connections to Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their creative work. And now, here's your host, author and Appalachian resident, Elliot Parker.
And hello, friends. We welcome you back once again to another episode of Now Appalachia. We are broadcast and distributed by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and it's great to have you with us for another program on the show. I'm your host, Elliot Parker, and it's great to have you with us. I'm delighted to have a repeat author back with us on the program today as our guest to talk about his brand new book. It is called Without Warning. This nonfiction book focuses on the tornado of Udall, Kansas. Our guest is Jim Minnick. He was with us a number of years ago when we first started the podcast, and we had him on to talk about his terrific novel called Fire Is Your Water. He's back today to talk to us about this brand new book called Without Warning, The Tornado of Udall, Kansas, which has been published by the University of Nebraska Press. And Jim Minnick joins us. He is the author or editor of 7 books, including that award-winning Fire Is Your Water novel, as well as the book The Blueberry Years, A Memoir of Farm and Family. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, Poets and Writers, Oxford American, Orion, and Shenandoah. And he currently serves as the co-editor of the literary journal Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel. So it is my pleasure to welcome Jim Minnick back to the program. We haven't talked to you for a while, Jim, but glad to have you back on, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you, and it's great to be back, Elliot. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be with you as well. And I wanted to ask you first about this, because I'd read some other interviews you'd given about this book, and you had been interested in this story about this tornado in Udall, Kansas for quite some time. But my first question is, what got you interested in this? Where did you first hear about this? And what made you kind of think, you know, this would be something that you would want to pursue as a writer in terms of telling the story?
So I just finished the novel, one of the first full drafts of the novel, Fire Is Your Water, as you know, about that book. And then I was looking for another project, and one of my favorite writers is Fred Chappell, and he has written 4 books of poetry and 4 books of fiction, one with each element. And so I'd just done Fire, so I was looking at some of the other elements. I thought that was pretty neat. I might want to do that. So my sister-in-law grew up in this little town in Kansas, and heard me talking about these elements and ideas that I was looking. And she said, well, my little town, hometown, got wiped out by a tornado. Some kind of wind for you. And I said, you are right. And so that's what got us started. And that conversation probably happened in 2010. And I went out the first summer. I started doing interviews in Kansas with survivors was 2011. So yeah, it was a long time coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of paraphrase or summarize the book for the audience, this tornado in Udall, Kansas occurred at 10:35 p.m. back on May 25th, 1955. It sort of tore through the town, destroyed most of the town's buildings, toppled the water tower, killed 82 people. And your book very much examines sort of how it happened, what happened, when it happened, and kind of the aftermath of that. But I also know that in a couple interviews you've given, you made this comment, and I was going to read it to the audience or share it with the audience and have you kind of elaborate or provide some context to it. And you said about this book, you said, the Udall tornado is not really my story. What did you mean by that?
So I've never lived east of the Appalachians, really east of the Mississippi, or west of the Appalachians, or west of the Mississippi. I've never lived in Kansas. I've never been in a tornado. I wasn't even alive in 1955. So, you know, for me to connect to this story personally was, you know, those connections weren't real strong. The more I talked to people, the more I realized how powerful of a story it was. And so for me to write the book, it had to become my story. You know, I had to imagine my way back into all of these people's, the survivors, well, the, some of the dead people as well. Imagine their, my way back into their lives and use their stories, expand on their stories to create a story of the whole community and the survival of this whole community. So yeah, it was a challenge, and I should kind of a part, another part of that question or issue is I originally, you know, I just finished this novel, so I was really thinking I'd be looking for another fiction, another novel project. And that's what I went into these interviews with thinking. And then as soon as I started hearing the interviews and just the generosity of these people sharing their stories and the trust they were giving me, I realized I couldn't make this into a novel. It would be a disservice to the story and to these people. So pretty early on, I realized I had to make it a nonfiction. And that to respect and honor all those things, but that made it a lot more difficult. So if it had been fiction, it would have been, I wouldn't have had to double check everything. And yeah, it was a lot harder.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that happened. So.
Excellent. Very good. So just to kind of set the scene for us, explain to our audience and explain to us kind of where Udall, Kansas is. Take us back to that year, 1955. What was the town like, you know, prior to this tornado that just devastated their community? You know, where is it? What's the community like? What were the people like? And then, in your opinion, were they ever the same, or will they ever be the same after that tornado? Because, you know, if you think about lineage, you know, they're just a generation, almost two now, removed from that tornado. But as you noted and wrote about in your book, there's still some survivors that live there. So what was Udall kind of like before the tornado? And do you think they'll ever be the same after this event, even though it's been, you know, a number of decades since?
So Udall is roughly 23, 25 miles south of Wichita. So it's in many ways people live in Udall and drive that distance. Wichita has some pretty big factories, Coleman and Air Boeing and other industries. The population then and pretty much now is around 600 people. It might be a little bigger now. There's also a lot of agriculture in the area, so a lot of that kind of industry is part of the town. At the time, 1955, it had a downtown. It still does, but it's much emptier. But it had, I don't know how many stores, maybe six or seven or eight stores of different kinds, grocery as well as, you know, kind of, I think it was a clothing store and five and dime kind of store. It has had and still has its own bank, post office, obviously, community center, community building is called. Railroad goes through it. That was and still is a big part of it. It has a granary, so that's kind of the industry. Oh, and it has its own high school and elementary school. And it did then, and it still does now. The tornado wiped out all those businesses and the schools and the churches. It had three churches. It still might have at least two, probably three or four churches. So you know, small town. Everybody knows everybody or is related to everybody. And here comes this tornado and kills 10% of the population, basically, and injures I think 270 people roughly. So, you know, over half the population was either killed or injured. And yeah, so. Did I answer all your questions?
Yes. Certainly did.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing, one other part. There was, I don't know that they're there now. There might be one, but there was three. They were called, at the time, they're called care homes. were like private nursing homes. And so there are several elderly people that lived in these private homes. There were three of them in town. So the tornado came at 10:35 p.m. So there was no warning. So most everybody had gone to bed. And if they hadn't gone to bed, they had turned the TV off and the radios off. And so I forget if it's a third or fourth of the dead were the elderly, because they couldn't, they were in their houses and they couldn't even get out. And then the other third or fourth was children, people under 18, I think. So, it is just complete surprise and complete devastation.
And I love how the first part of the book, you don't shy away from the people that are injured. I mean, you vividly describe, there was a wound in one man's neck, and he was bleeding severely when he was found. There was another story about a police officer who was driving through Udall that nearly had his car blown over, and he turned around to go back to Udall to get some help. And I believe Officer Thompson, I think, was his name. And by the time he got back to Udall, it was too late. The town had already been destroyed. And there was another scene where you describe a sort of a wedding party where the ceiling tiles start to fall in right when they're in the middle of the wedding or the reception. And so you don't shy away from that. I mean, I love that you remind the readers that, I don't want to say that we sometimes eulogize tornadoes, but, we've seen so many, cheesy movies over the years about these tornadoes that, the freak storms and these sci-fi movies and where tornadoes just break out all over the country. And there's, a love story worked in, and there's sort of a romantic, heroic thing about surviving a tornado. But you give us kind of the early on the raw, visceral consequences of when something like this hits any town. And it doesn't matter if it's 1955 or 2015 or whenever it is, that these are real people affected. And I was wondering when you were looking at that information and interviewing people about that, did that come up a lot? Did when you're talking to the survivors, did they talk about those things in terms of who was injured and who was killed and who they knew that was injured, if it was a friend or a family member? Or was that something that maybe they mentioned sort of in passing and you had to go back and fill in the gaps there? Can you talk about that in terms of their willingness to talk about kind of what really happened on the devastation destruction front with the tornado?
Most part, the people were pretty willing to talk about it. And if I asked more questions, it was just for clarity or specifics or just to make sure I heard right. There were some people that were reluctant or downplayed some of the injuries or the death, but just out of, I think, courtesy and respect. And I tried, I wanted to honor that. I didn't want to overdo it, and I didn't want to press too hard. There were so many survivors and survivor stories, but one of the most powerful ones for me was Bobby Atkinson, I think, kind of one of the main characters in the book. And he was 15 at the time, and he heard the tornado coming just in time. And this part just amazes me. He lifted the window screen and then jumped out. He didn't jump through the screen. He lifted the screen and he was able to crouch down beside the house foundation right before the whole house was just completely destroyed. And he said the first, and I think it was the first wall of the tornado, but it could have been, I've talked to some weather experts after the book came out, and they said it could have been two tornadoes, but it was probably the first front wall of the tornado. Bobby said it was so strong it took all of his clothes off, but it didn't really hurt him. And then there was a lull, and I'm guessing that's the eye of the tornado. And he actually looked up and looked around and saw that there was no house where he had just been, and there was he shared a bedroom with two younger brothers. There's no younger brothers, and his parents were in the house at the time too, and he didn't see them at all either. And he's just horrified. And then the second wall came, and that's what had all the debris. And he said it felt like Somebody was shooting a shotgun out of his back at close range, and somebody else was hitting him on the head with a ball peen hammer over and over and over. And his injuries were just incredible. Broken leg and two broken arms, and his right hand was so mangled that it was just mashed. Severe concussion. They eventually had to put plates in his head, I think. Debris like all through his body, like splinters and you know, pebbles and all kinds of debris just embedded in his skin. Including a 2x2 that punctured his chest, the back chest cavity, and hit one lung, and it didn't go all the way through, but it was, you know, 2x2 was sticking out of his back, and he survived. In fact, he had to crawl after, I forget how many hours, 5 hours waiting in a car for somebody to come rescue him. He realized nobody was coming, and so he crawled. He had to crawl with broken arms. He crawled a half mile to the edge of town where he caught a ride with somebody to go to the and took him to the hospital. So, I mean, the injuries were, yeah, incredible. And I didn't want to overdo it, but I didn't want to underdo it either. So that was a kind of a fine line to walk.
Yeah, very good. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, a lot of the interviews that you did and interviewing with the survivors. How do you determine from a writer's perspective which stories to include and how to structure that? You know, if you're interviewing 15 or 20 people and you know you're only going to be able to include so many of those accounts and testimonies in your book, how do you determine that as a writer in terms of whose stories you want to tell, who's getting included, who's getting left out, and then the organization of, you know, whose story is going to get told first versus second and all of that? How does that happen? And is that a difficult process as maybe it sounds when you explain it or think about it, structuring the book that way with all of that?
It was difficult in a couple of different ways. There's a couple hurdles that I didn't anticipate that I had to deal with along the way. Since it happened in 1955, a lot of the people who survived were already dead. And so my pool of survivors, you know, was already smaller than probably like what a more recent tornado or disaster would be. So I was basically talking to whoever was available at the time. And then, yeah, I started to figure out, yeah, that person I can follow through the whole better. Bobby definitely, you know, was important to keep, you know, Bobby eventually learned that both his brothers died instantly. His mother died a couple days after because of injuries from the storm. And then his father lived, but he was so mangled, he was unrecognizable when he brought, it was like one of the last ones brought into the hospital. And he lived for another 6 months. He had had cancer, and that's what eventually killed him. But Bobby was in 6 months. And so, you know, that story I knew I wanted to keep. But one of the things I encountered, or I wanted to develop, I should say, one of the things I encountered maybe a third of the way through the project was like, I realized that all the people that I've been talking to were either too young to really be part of the rebuilding, or they were, they didn't live in town, or they were in the hospital. They were injured. Like Bobby was in hospital for months afterwards. And I wanted to tell the story of the rebuilding as well. And so, that put me in a little bit of a bind, and I realized the main character I needed to develop and try to explore and make central was the mayor. His name was Earl Rao, and everybody called him Toots, his nickname. But he had died in the 1980s, and so how do you interview somebody from the dead? And you don't. But his oldest daughter was still alive and lived in town, and she was a huge help. And so I was able to develop the whole family story essentially. And there was a lot of newspaper coverage. So, you know, I had, I don't know how many hundreds of hours of interviews that were, you know, the kind of the main part of the book research. But I also spent a lot of hours, probably 100 hours in the libraries, looking through old newspapers. And so the Rao family, since he was the mayor at the time, they were covered in the newspapers a lot. So for me, you know, that choosing whose story to tell involved who was available, who had maybe the most fascinating, interesting story, and then who was there for the whole timeline of the story. So, it was not easy, but it was fascinating to try to figure out as well.
We're speaking with author Jim Minnick today on this episode of Now Appalachia. He's the author of the brand new nonfiction book. It's called Without Warning, The Tornado of Udall, Kansas, published by the University of Nebraska Press. And Jim, we'll come back to the book in just a second. I wanted to ask you another question about your career, sort of tied into this book, but really all of your works. And that is, you've received a number of grants over the years from organizations like the Virginia Commission for the Arts, the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, Augusta University, Georgia Humanities Council, and other places. And you taught at Augusta University and at Radford University in Virginia for a long time. But how important are those grants and slash fellowships that you get from those organizations in terms of helping you do what you do and write these kinds of books, these nonfiction books that are very time intensive and laborious in terms of having to go and visit and research and all of that? And I know you do a lot of that for your fiction novels as well and your other work, your memoirs too. How important are those grants to writers? And if we've got a writer listening, would you encourage them to seek out these kinds of grants and fellowships in their own communities or in their own states?
Certainly. I mean, yeah, definitely. They are important. They are great rewards, great support, great recognition. And definitely, you know, if you have the opportunity, like some states, like I know North Carolina is very supportive with their artists in this way, with their writers, definitely you know, explore those. A lot of those grants, I should say that I was awarded were not for me personally as a writer, but for the work I was doing, creating literary communities. A lot of the grants, so you know, kind of in a broader sense, the grants allowed me and universities to host writers, to create conferences that would help teachers incorporate Appalachian studies in their classrooms. That's some of the work I did a lot at Radford. So in a large, you know, they're definitely important to individual artists, but they're also very important for organizations to create literary communities to support those artists. So, you know, in the same way, I would get grant money to create a conference. I would then spend that grant money to bring writers to campus. So, you know, they are very, very essential and important. And I wish governments funded the arts much more. I think we're learning more and more how essential the arts are to just our health. But yeah, so.
Excellent. Very good. Yeah.
We need them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And wish there were more of them and wish they were in higher dollar amounts than they are, so that authors could have the money to do the work that you're talking about. And also, as you said, for folks involved on the educational side, of their careers and their work to help support and promote Appalachian authors better, and to bring those Appalachian authors to campus and expose them to not only college students, but, you know, high school, middle school, and elementary school students as well. So my next question, if we were to slip into your study or to wherever it is that you like to read, and we were to look at your pile of books that might be on your desk or your table, what are some books we might see there, either in ones that you've just finished or ones that are in your to-be-read pile? Well, what are some things you've read recently that you liked, and maybe what's in your to-be-read pile that you're looking forward to getting to?
So I've been on a Willa Cather kick. This summer when I was on book tour for this Without Warning book. I was able to travel all over Kansas and really enjoy the prairie, but I also able to go to Willa Cather country in Nebraska. And she's one of my favorite writers, and it was a great, great fortune to see her little hometown, as well as a farm that's the setting for two of my favorite pieces. One is My Antonia. So I've been reading a bunch of Willa Cather. So that's one of the favorite authors I've been exploring a lot. And then more contemporary, I've been looking forward to reading David Joy's newest book. He's a friend who I've known for several years and have hosted him to campus, as well as going hikes for them. And he's got a new novel coming out in, I think, the end of this month. So, yeah, it's one that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, very good. And, yeah. a shameless plug for the program. We're going to have David on our program in a future
episode
to talk about his new book. It's called Those We Thought We Knew.
Yeah, I
had a chance to read an arc, and boy, it's terrific, just like all his books are. So I'm definitely looking forward to having him back on to talk about that. So right now, though, we're talking with the author. Yes, absolutely. And right now we're talking with Jim Minnick, who's the author of the brand new book. It is called Without Warning, The Tornado of Udall, Kansas. And Jim, we're running low on time, so I wanted to skip ahead and ask you a question related to sort of maybe the end of the book, or kind of a final impression. When a reader kind of gets to the last page and they've read your story about the people and what happened, and not only the physical and emotional injuries that they suffered, but how they went about rebuilding the community, what is a lasting impression you hope they take away from the book? Or someone who maybe hasn't read a lot of nonfiction and picks this book up and reads it, what's sort of the final takeaway, or the big takeaway, or the main impression you hope they walk away from the book with?
The power of community, the power of resilience of individuals working, surviving, and working to rebuild a place they love that was destroyed by some kind of natural disaster. I think that's kind of the bedrock of the story, is community totally wiped out, and here they are. They're still here. So 60, almost 70 years later, they're still here. So, yeah.
Excellent. And have you talked to any of the folks that you interviewed who have read the book? And if so, what have they said about it? How do they think you handled the story and handled what they said and all of that? Have you gotten any feedback from them yet?
Yes. And that was a huge, I was a little nervous about that. Yeah. So here I am using other people's stories. Here's a whole community that gave me their story that hopefully I got right. So May 25th of this past year, the anniversary of the tornado, I was, that was my last stop on my Kansas book tour, there in Udall, in the community building that had been, you know, part of the tornado story. And so I was very honored to be part of that, celebration of the community as well as the book. And both that night of the event, but also so that the book came out, the official release date was May 1st, but the book was really available and people were reading it in the community, like even April 1st, I think, but definitely early April. And so they were reading it and they were talking to each other, and I was kind of listening from the sidelines, and I was very relieved and pleased that they all liked it, and they felt like they told the story and honored them. So, and that definitely came through on the May 25th event. I was very happy and relieved and honored that the book was well received by, you know, that's kind of the main audience in a lot of ways. So, yeah, thanks for asking that.
Absolutely. And so my final question, Jim, with you today, as we wrap up our discussion, if anyone wants to get in contact with you to find out more information about this book or about Fire Is Your Water or other things that you've written or what you've got going on with your writing and book tours and all of that, how can they follow you and stay in contact with you, first of all? And then where can they get copies of your book without warning?
So I have a webpage. It's my name with a hyphen in the middle. So www.jim-minick.com. Jim-minick.com. And there's a page on that. You can enter your contact form and I'd be glad to correspond with you through email. I'm on Facebook. I usually avoid it, but I can also be reached there. But the best way is through the contact form through my webpage. And on the webpage, you can find out more about the books. And there are links to places to buy it. I try to support independent bookstores, but so there's some links for that, as well as Amazon is another option as well. I think that answers that.
The title of the book is Without Warning, The Tornado of Udall, Kansas, a devastating tornado that occurred out in the Midwest in Udall, Kansas, back on May 22, 1955. Our guest today has been author Jim Minick. He's not only the author of this book, but the author of the tremendous and fantastic novel that we had him on a few years ago to talk about. It's called Fire Is Your Water. I would encourage you to check that out as well as The Blueberry Years, A Memoir of Farm and Family, and a number of other publications. Jim, congratulations on this really great book. And I think there are so many things about family, community, people, resilience, so many great themes that readers will take away from this, and appreciate not only your time and effort on telling the story, but the great way in which you did it. So congratulations on the book, and all the best to you.
Thank you so much, Elliot. It's been great talking to you. Thank you for your work as well. So take care.
We want to take a moment as we finish up on this episode of Now Appalachia to give a special shout out and a thank you to our executive producer. Her name is Pam Stack. She makes all of these podcasts possible. Each and every episode, not only with Now Appalachia, but with all of the programming that you hear on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We couldn't do it without her. So thanks to all of her efforts behind the scenes to make these podcasts possible. We also want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And that is going to do it for us this time on Now Appalachia, but please come again next time. And in the meantime, stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
You've been listening to Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. For questions or comments about this program, and to learn more about the host, Elliot Parker, and his books, visit his website at www.elliotparker.com. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next from the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.